From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. It took almost 30 years for Aung San Suu Kyi to become Myanmar's leader, including 15 years under house arrest. Her persistence won her the Nobel Peace Prize, and 2 years ago, she became state counselor, presiding over a fragile and infant democracy. But this champion of human rights is facing an ethical crisis. The military, which she doesn't control, is killing and displacing Rohingya Muslim minorities. But she stayed silent. The United States and some European countries are now proposing sanctions against Myanmar. But is Suu Kyi's silence the price of an infant democracy? Former Australian Liberal politician Ian McPhee is the author of a new book on Myanmar. As immigration minister in the Fraser government, he was also the architect of Australian multiculturalism. Ian McPhee, however, is reluctant to judge Suu Kyi. He spoke to Andrew West.
They're being critical of her without understanding the issues that she is facing and the complexity of those issues. She has said several times publicly that she wants to be an effective politician, not just an idealist who will actually be displaced by the military. Mm. She realises that's the perilous position she's in. That's why she didn't then go to the UN General Assembly meeting, because when they would have decried the genocide that was going on, the ethnic cleansing and the Rohingya people, she would have had to agree with them, and she then might not have been allowed back into Myanmar. Mm. So she really takes the view that she has so many problems to deal with, and she does, that to risk being displaced by the military at this moment would be not in the interest of the country. So she's prepared to basically live with a harsh international judgment of her.
Yeah. I understand, Ian, you're saying that she wants to be an effective politician.
Yes.
Can I just, though, reflect, you were an effective politician. You were also a principled politician. People should be reminded. You took a stand against your own party, against racial discrimination in immigration. Is it too much to ask a world leader to be both effective and principled?
She's extremely principled in her approach to everything, but on that issue, she was faced with a dreadful dilemma. The military, first of all, made a savage response, but it did follow brutal attacks last October and in August of this year, and the Rohingya Muslims were seen throughout Myanmar as a threat, especially as IS or ISIS is spreading from Pakistan across to Bangladesh, which the British used to call East Pakistan. There's a lot spreading across there, and we know it's in the Philippines and so on. So she couldn't run the risk of appearing to want to defend an invasion which is originally initiated by the ISIS people. It's a huge problem for her when she has so many other challenges with 8 indigenous races, 135 clans, different languages. She has massive challenge on her plate to try and rewrite the constitution that she is working hard on and to spread education and health. She just had to say, well, if they displace me as leader, those things won't be done.
So we're being asked in that circumstance, though, Ian, to say, well, the price of democracy or of continued democratization in Myanmar is turning a blind eye to the persecution of the Rohingya. Is that the choice that the world faces?
Well, I think they've got to understand this is a particularly one-off complexity within the Myanmar structure. The Rohingya people have been there for centuries on the Myanmar side of the border. They've also been over on the Bangladesh side. No one, not least Suu Kyi, could possibly justify her military's behaviour. But frankly, if she now were to criticise them in the same way that the international community is doing, she would lose her leadership and she would damage the country. Yeah. Whereas at the moment, she will be able to get Chinese and other support and keep going with her ambitions. So I think she's prepared to sacrifice her reputation. After all, the military action was very rapid, and she would never have been consulted about it. It would have all occurred before she was aware of it.
Mm. Let me ask you, because you've come to know Burma or Myanmar very well in the last 20 years,
yes.
What role is religion, though, playing as a divisive factor there? Because Buddhism is at one level the great glue that holds Burma with all its disparate tribes together, but is it also playing a divisive role, Ian?
It shouldn't be. It should be the uniting role, but as we know very well, Andrew, so many things have been done in the name of religion that have caused catastrophes for centuries. And in this case, the fear of an Islamic invasion into the Rakhine state by some Buddhists led them to behave in a way that the Buddha himself would never condone. I think, again, it's just a conflict. But elsewhere in Burma, Buddhism is still a uniting factor. There are only two other small Islamic groups in different parts of Burma or Myanmar, and the Buddhist element is very, very unifying. And so, on the whole, you've got to still be confident. However, there's no doubt that those that have behaved the way they have in Rohingya, including the military against the Rohingya, have betrayed the fundamental principles of Buddhism. Mm.
What would you say, for example, to the city of Oxford, which is where Aung San Suu Kyi studied and then lived for many years, that revoked her Freedom of the City Award?
I'm very disappointed, frankly. I don't think they came to understand the challenge that this wonderful woman is facing. And if they had taken any insights into the choices she had, she either goes down as a heroine who's achieved nothing by standing up to the military after they've created this brutal attack. Either she does that and disappears and is not able to help her people, or they have to understand what I've been trying to say.
Mm. Ian, what would you also then say to someone whom I know you hold in the highest regard, because you as an MP were very involved in the fight against apartheid, and that is Archbishop Desmond Tutu? He said, yes, my fellow Nobel Prize laureate needs to act against this persecution of the Rohingya.
Yes, he did. And he also said that there was no point in her being there if she didn't do so. I understand his point of view. I just feel that in terms of all that she's invested in, she's in her 73rd year now, after years of imprisonment and so on, to try and help her people unify. That's the crucial thing. Mm. Her biggest worry is one of total disunity. It could easily result that way. It's been held together over the years. She wants a constitution that has a federal system, but the policies are administered at the grassroots, because the village life is still very independent away from the capital in the way it was under the kings as well. Mm. I respect Tutu enormously, and I know that Suu Kyi would do the same. I just think that the sheer brutal reality of politics in Burma or Myanmar at the moment leads her to do what she's doing.
Xi Jinping may be the most powerful leader since Mao Zedong, but it seems there's one force that does frighten him, and that's religious faith. In the last 3.5 hours speech, Xi said religion needed to become Chinese-orientated. About 3 to 4 million Chinese worship regularly. That's according to a new book by China scholar Ian Johnson. He estimates about 70 million are Christian, 20 million are Muslim, and the rest are a mixture of Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and followers of a folk religion. They represent a challenge that the communist government tries to contain, so it downplays the numbers. But in his latest book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, Ian Johnson takes on the propaganda.
Yeah, the word religion in Chinese is a neologism that was coined about 100 years ago. And in the past, religion was not thought of as a separate part of society, something that you did on a certain day. It was part of the fabric of everyday life. And so there wasn't really a word like religion. And so it was coined, taken from the Japanese, and imported from the West. So when people hear the word religion in Chinese, that particular word, zongjiao, it has a very politicized, somewhat sensitive connotation. If you say, are you religious, people will often think, do you mean that am I an official in my church? Am I a warden in the church? Or am I a member of the lay Buddhist community? As opposed to, do you just go to church or do you just go to a temple? So you get very low figures of people if you say that word religion. If you say faith or belief, you get much, much higher things. And the key is to ask people what they do. Do you do this once a week or twice a week? Or do you believe that this or that God could have an effect in your life? Then you get very high response rates.
You write in the book, and I think this really sums up a lot of what you were saying, progress is not linear. Churches are demolished, temples are run for tourism, and debates about morality are manipulated for political gain. But the overall direction is clear. Faith and values are returning to the centre of national discussion over how to organise Chinese life. So how are these values now being elevated into the centre of a country that is still officially atheist?
On a couple of levels. On the popular level and in social media and things like that, in daily discussions, people are concerned that their society has no values other than making money. You can see this in these constant debates and hand-wringing over the lack of compassion in society. Just a month ago, a woman was run over at a pedestrian crossing, and nobody stopped to help her because they weren't sure what was going on. She wasn't a friend of theirs. They didn't know who she was. They didn't want to get involved. This attracted a huge amount of discussion. I think it was the equivalent of being retweeted 80,000 times on social media in China. People saying, you know, what's come of our society? What is wrong with us? On that level, you get a lot of discussion, a lot of interest. And then on the political level, the government realizes there is a sense of a moral vacuum, and it's trying to take that high ground and occupy it and determine the parameters of debate and discussion about this. So this is a big part of Xi Jinping's domestic agenda. It's something that doesn't get a lot of attention in the West, but it's trying to create some sort of more moral society.
I mean, wasn't Confucianism the basis of a public morality, though?
Indeed, it was. And I think this is why China, just like traditional societies at least, morality was an important part of daily life. People tried to live a good life according to certain moral precepts. The government is allowing bits of Confucianism to come back in traditional morality. I think they hope to co-opt it, to use it for their own purposes, to solidify their legitimacy. In a way, you might draw a parallel to Russia under Vladimir Putin, who has done an about-face from being a KGB man to supporting traditional values, the Orthodox Church, Russian traditional values, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, and being declared by the Patriarch of Moscow to be a gift from God or something.
Yeah, it's sort of absurd almost. But it's not quite that far. You don't have, say, abbots from Buddhist temples anointing Xi Jinping. But the government has, and Xi Jinping specifically, has said very positive things about Buddhism, about Confucianism. He meets Buddhist leaders. He's gone to Confucius's hometown and said very favorable things about Confucian. I think they view those kind of religions, the so-called traditional religions, Buddhism and Taoism and folk religion, more favorably. They're more skeptical about Islam and Christianity because of the perceived foreign ties and this worry that religion could undermine their rule.
Ian, I've been a journalist for over 20 years now, and the story coming out of China for 2.5 decades has been one of prosperity, constant prosperity. The sort of secular orthodoxy is that the wealthier people get, the less religious they become. So why is this inverse in China?
Well, that's right. We had the same discussion in the West. There were people in the 50s and 60s who posited that religion would die out as we got more prosperous and rational and things like that. And there's still a big atheist movement in the West. Similarly, in China, communism is, after all, part of that same modernizing theory. There was this idea, even when religion was allowed again after the Cultural Revolution in the 80s, people in the leadership thought, oh, it'll just die out. It won't last for very long. But I think people need something in their lives that is more than just getting rich. Somebody I talked to said, we thought we were unhappy because we're poor. And now a lot of us aren't poor anymore, but we're still unhappy. And there's something missing in our lives. And, you know, I have to say, not everybody's turning to religion, but a significant number of people are. Maybe because this modernization, this economic growth at all costs has been so brutally pushed through over the past four decades almost, that people are reacting against it and feel a need for just something else in their lives, some sort of values that make life more meaningful.
I wonder though, Ian, if there's also a sort of Chinese version of the prosperity gospel, it's called in, well, certainly North American Protestantism. Is there a prosperity gospel in China that crosses, you know, all of the faiths, Christian, Taoist, Buddhist, that also reinforces the message? I know the provenance of the quote, to get rich is glorious, is highly disputed, but you really can't mistake the sentiment that's been going on there.
No, that's true. All the religions also have, just as you said, with the prosperity gospel in the United States, there's this idea that religion can also help make you more prosperous. And so when you go to temples, say Buddhist temples or Taoist temples, people are often worshiping, hoping to get richer, get wealthier, or that their business deal won't go sour, or that their daughter or son will pass the university entrance test. So there is sometimes a real quid pro quo going on when you hear people worshiping and talking, you know, churches as well. You get similar ideas that God will make us prosperous. People often will say, and it's sort of a vulgar understanding of Western history, but they'll say, well, look, the most advanced countries are Protestant or Christian, at least. Therefore, Christianity is not incompatible with modernism, with prosperity, and maybe will even help us get richer.
Yeah. It's the Religion and Ethics Report, Andrew West with you, my guest, one of the world's leading scholars of China, Ian Johnson. Ian's latest book is The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. Ian, your book is full of these wonderful vignettes. Tell me about the celebrity Zen Buddhists who give inspiration to these Chinese real estate moguls.
Yeah, well, this is a very old man who has subsequently passed away, Nan Huaijin, and he is something like, you know, people still remember Will and Ariel Durant, who wrote this series, The Story of Western Civilization. And this guy, Master Nan, he has written hundreds of books, all explaining Chinese civilization, explaining the classics. And he's also a Zen master himself, who's been formally recognized as having achieved enlightenment. People went to his retreat in central China, not too far from Shanghai, and would go there for weekend talks with him and have dinner with him and ask him all kinds of advice. And one time, the case you're referring to, I think it was quite telling. This real estate developer had quite a bit of money and was looking for another deal to do. And he asked Master Nan, should I invest in a cure for Alzheimer's? I believe there's a cure for Alzheimer's. And Master Nan, who at that time was something like 95 years old, said, there is no cure for old age. This is a waste of money. And then immediately turned around and said, well, what about electric batteries for cars? And Master Nan said, oh, that's good. That's future-oriented. And so the real estate mogul invested in car batteries. And maybe this is why China is, you know, going through a green revolution now, for all I know. But there is this desire to know, what's the ethical answer to questions? And this idea that, how do I live a proper life now that I've got money? And so for some people, these masters, these traditional faiths and values offer answers.
It seems to me a little bit like the vein of the Christianity that emerged with Norman Vincent Peale, you know, the power of positive thinking, the sort of self-help Christianity. Are we getting that self-help Buddhism, self-help Taoism?
There is a lot of that also. If you go to train stations or especially airports, go to the airport bookshops, so much of it is self-help, answering questions about how to live a proper life. There are these masters who offer lessons on the equivalent of YouTube in China, and they offer retreats. Some people, I know a friend paid the equivalent of $10,000 US dollars, so it was something like 60,000 yuan for a year's membership, and she could go then every weekend if she wanted to fast at this retreat and talk to Buddhist monks about ethical issues and learn to meditate and things like that. So there's a huge hunger, not only among yuppies, but among a wide range of people.
Ian, one of the major characters in your book, a recurring character, is a fascinating man, Wang Yi. He's the pastor of the Early Rain Reformed Church. What does Wang Yi represent about the religious revival in China?
On a broader level, he represents what may be the fastest growing religion in China, which is Protestant Christianity. There were only 1 million Protestants in 1949 when the communists took over. There are now, conservatively, say 50 to 60 million Protestants. It's really, really taken off. And I think here, Wang Yi's church in the fairly prosperous city of Chengdu in southwestern China, it's this well-to-do, educated, white-collar population that is also looking for something. Wang Yi is a former human rights lawyer who converted to Christianity not too long ago, in just 2005, but already has a church with several hundred members.
Do these Protestant churches in China, the type of which Wang Yi leads, do they take anything at all, Ian, from the Western, and specifically the American model of the evangelical megachurch?
Somewhat. They are influenced by the West because some people, not Wang Yi himself, but some other people like him, say, if you think of this as a broader class, have been to the United States to study in seminaries. There's a lot of information that's downloaded on the internet, put up there by Chinese American Christians, Hong Kong as well, Taiwan. So they're influenced by overseas Christians quite a bit. Also, you can see this in discussions about abortion, for example, maybe it's even a source of concern for the government because the government doesn't like these kind of foreign ties.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the Chinese diaspora, because in Australia, you can go to some very big evangelical congregations and Pentecostal congregations, and 30, 40% of the congregation, and we're talking thousands of people, will be Chinese. They'll be young Chinese, they'll be university students. So I'm just wondering if that diaspora is feeding back into the religious revival in China.
No, absolutely. One of the great advantages that Chinese in the diaspora have is that when they come back to China, they can come in, say, on a tourist visa, just like other people, but they may not stick out quite as much when they go into the church. And many people who have a theological education come back to China and hold workshops, Bible study. Wang Yi's church has a seminary, and some foreign Christians come in, but they prefer if they're ethnically Chinese, because then when they come into the building, the guards below won't notice quite as much as if a Caucasian were coming in. So there's a big advantage there. And of course, the language may also be a factor.
Is the style, Ian, though, what we've become accustomed to seeing, the rock music and the sort of speaking in tongues, that kind of preaching? Or I'm just wondering, maybe it's a little more sedate. Maybe they're not quite there yet.
Well, you know, there's some of that. I think there's actually more of that in the past in rural China. There was this Pentecostal movement in places like Hunan in the countryside where people would have visions, there'd be speaking in tongues. Wang Yi's church is interesting because they're really looking for traditions, and they have declared themselves to be a Reformed Christian church. So they are looking at Geneva and John Calvin for their inspiration. And they have actually thought this through very carefully, why they want to become Reformed Christians. They've thought about the role of the Puritans in the United States, the role of this in the founding even of American democracy. It's fairly intellectualized. There's a loose network of Reformed churches around China. They see it as a maybe a little more, I hate to use the word fundamentalist, but it's a little stricter form of Christianity with clear rules and order about what you can do and what you can't do. And that appeals to Chinese people, I think, on the whole, because there's this feeling that there's a lack of rules in society, that anything goes. And this kind of Christianity is much more appealing. And it was kind of funny because I talked to a German woman in Chengdu who had converted a number of these people about 15 years ago. And she was more of a sort of modern Western Christian who had a little ukulele and played it in the park and taught them all kinds of folk songs and things like that. I thought it was like hippie parents who have children who turn out to be accountants, because all of the people who she... Yeah, all the people she converted ended up being Reformed Christians, you know, singing hymns from the 18th century and 19th century. And she and her husband were flabbergasted that this had happened.
Yeah, well,
but somehow it happened.
Yeah, well, there's a wonderful scene that you set where, you know, part of the Christian revival in China is taking place in this city that you basically say it's relatively remote from Beijing, although you can get around everywhere now on the high-speed trains, but it's the hippie capital of China.
Yeah, no, Chengdu is the big alternative lifestyle capital of China. It's got a big gay community. It's got a big alternative life, alternative education. Rudolf Steiner's ideas, Waldorf education is really big in Chengdu. It's far away from Beijing, so it isn't as uptight as the capital. And I think it's not a coincidence that you also find this religious life also percolating below the surface because it's a little more freewheeling.
Just finally, we've spoken a lot, Ian, about the religious revival in China, but we do need to remember and be frank about the ongoing religious repression. How willing is the sort of nominally communist regime to allow this space for religion?
Well, one of the things that the communists did after communism collapsed in Eastern Europe in 1989-1990 is they studied what had happened there, and they noted the role of the Catholic Church in Poland or the Protestant Church in East Germany, not to mention the Solidarity Trade Union and so on. They decided we do not want civil society to exist in China. Mm. They tolerate many unregistered churches and temples, but by and large, if anything political is going on, or if you try to create a national network that is not under the government's control, the government will crack down hard. If it's just personal piety, that's okay. If it gets anywhere into the social activism sphere, the government is much less comfortable with that. Even on something like environmental protection, religious groups getting involved with that, it's very, very skeptical. So this is where the persecution, the crackdowns primarily occur. It's when the government thinks that religion is becoming too strong of a force.
And that was Ian Johnson, author of the book, The Souls of China. He's also a Beijing-based journalist, and he was speaking there with Andrew West. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. As we mentioned on the program last week, this month of December, we're bringing you some special features, and this was the first in a series of special programs. Listeners in the Pacific, however, who receive the 3x daily edition of Focus Asia Pacific, will be receiving our normal fare. So, until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.